I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There is a dividing line in America, and it's not between Democrats and Republicans or even right-wingers and left-wingers. It's between those who have a university degree and those who don't. Bacha Ungasagon is the deputy editor of Newsweek. She travelled the country talking to people from different backgrounds who, she says, mostly share one thing in common. They feel like there is a class of elites hoarding the American dream of financial stability and home ownership, unless you have a university degree. Her new book is called Second Class: How the Elites Betrayed America's Working Men and Women. And Bacha Ungasagon joins me now. Hi.
Hi, Jesse. Thanks so much for having me back.
You traveled America talking to real people for this book. How rare is that in 2024 for a journalist?
It's certainly not common. You know, it's so much easier to sit in your home office and pontificate. I don't see it a lot, I have to admit.
I'll bet. And were you surprised by what you heard on the road?
Oh, I was so surprised, Jesse. Mostly by how not polarized the working class is. There was so much consensus on the issues between working class Democrats and working class Republicans. And people just lived in mixed communities. They lived in communities that were racially diverse, that were politically diverse, that were religiously diverse. And it would just never occur to someone to hold it against their fellow American, you know, who they voted for. It was so not an issue, as opposed to among the elites, among journalists, among politicians, where polarization is very much a motivating factor because, of course, it gives them a lot of power.
Polarization, we hear heaps about that these days. And is it your thesis that in Los Angeles, if you're a Democrat and somebody votes Republican, you probably won't go out to dinner with them, whereas that divide doesn't really exist in, I don't know, Wyoming?
You know, there are working class people in every state, so I would say it's not based really on the state, yeah. But it's based whether you are sort of in one of those industries that, you know, requires a college education, in one of those knowledge industry jobs that have really become those sort of a motor for upward mobility for the smart set. Those are the people who are the most polarized. They come out of university. If they are Republicans, they become extremely attached to the Republican Party and the sort of list of priorities of the Republican Party. If they're liberals, which is most often the case when somebody gets a college degree, they come out of it and they look at the sort of Democratic Party's list of agenda items and it's sort of like check, 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 check. They really subscribe to all those views. And the reason for that is because those views were cultivated to appeal to them. Both parties are catering to their rich elites at this point on either side. But if you're a working class person, you develop your own ideas about what would help you. And neither party, because neither party is catering to the working class, neither party really reflects that ideology. And as a result, working class people have very little spiritual or psychological investment in politics.
Yeah. So which comes to my next point, is there a problem when a Democrat, or as we would know them here in New Zealand, a left-wing member of the elite, as you put it, when they start constructing policies and viewpoints that they think are in the benefits of their working-class left-wing counterparts?
Yeah, 100%. And here's what happens. Over the last 40 years, the leftist elites went from being a cultural elite that lived among working class people and made sort of on a par the same amount of money as sort of a high working class person. to becoming an economic elite. They're now the top 20%, and they are hoarding over 50% of the GDP in this country. So they're a cultural elite and an economic elite. They do not live amongst the working class anymore, but they still see themselves as the good guys, as, you know, standing up for the little guy. But because they don't know any working class people, they have constructed an agenda to cater to the quote unquote little guy that is totally at odds with how working class people see themselves. And to summarize it, I would say the culture that prevails among these leftist elites is one very much affiliated with a kind of paternalistic view of the world. They believe in institutions and in the government because they have done what those institutions and the government have done very well for these elites. They have benefited very much from big institutions, which have sort of risen their fortunes in a very literal sense. And so when they look at the working class and they see working class people struggling to achieve the American dream, their answer is, well, let's give them more money. Let's give them more welfare. Let's expand the welfare state. I'm willing to pay higher taxes. You could take it out of my paycheck, and I'm happy to give them free housing or food stamps or, you know, free this or free that. The problem is, Jesse, working class people are not, they don't believe in paternalism. They believe in autonomy. They get a lot of dignity out of the work that they do. And all they want is for that work to give them in exchange the most modest form of the American dream, the most modest form of a stable life. And so you can see how the ways in which the leftists are trying to help them are totally at odds with what working class people actually want.
A lot of working class people voted for Trump. Why do, and I'll just use this term elite as a shorthand, as you have, I'm sure, in the title of the book, so people will know who I'm talking about, college-educated people in the cities with knowledge economy jobs. So why do the elite think that working class people vote for Trump, and why do they vote for Trump?
So what you'll hear in the leftist media is the idea summarized by this book, White Rural Rage. The view that the leftists push about why the working class votes for Trump is that they're racist, right? In short, they hate immigrants. They're xenophobic. They're bigoted. They're backward. They believe in conspiracy theories. They've been hypnotized by influencers on the right, yada, yada. It's the sort of updated version of the Thomas Frank argument, what's the matter with Kansas? They've been bamboozled by, you know, right-wing talk radio hosts into putting their economic interests ahead of their, to putting their cultural ideology ahead of their economic interests. Nothing could be further from the truth. The working class people I interviewed and working class people in general are extremely savvy about economics because they have to be. When you're living on a shoestring budget and you have, you know, $200 in your bank account, you're very, very aware of what economic policies hurt you and which ones help you. And they saw in Trump a champion because he championed them from an economic point of view. You have to understand, when Trump showed up on the scene, there were two parties engaged in a handshake agreement that we should have free trade with China and basically ship as many jobs overseas in exchange for cheap imports. I mean, that was, both parties agreed with that ideology when Trump showed up. NAFTA was signed into law by a Democrat. And Trump showed up and said, we're not going to have free trade. We're going to have a trade war with China. We're going to have 25% tariffs put on steel and aluminum, protect those jobs. We're going to put tariffs on every import, right? He really spoke their language. Tariffs are very important to working class people because they put money back in their pockets. And so he really revolutionized the American economy. The idea of America first had nothing to do with race, nothing to do with xenophobia, and everything to do with putting a stop to the downward mobility of the working class. Immigration, another great example. You know, for the leftist elites, who, by the way, benefit economically in major ways from an open border, you know, immigration is all about, I mean, it's about economics, let's be honest, but in their minds, they don't see it that way. They have this whole narrative that it's about, you know, morality, asylum, you know, although most of the migrants, 95% of the migrants who come to America are not asylum seekers, although they are economic migrants. You know, but actually, for working class people, immigration is about economics. These immigrants who come here are people who are not going to work in the knowledge industry. They're going to be competing with the working class for their jobs and driving down the wages in those jobs simply by supplying more labor in working class jobs. And so it really is class warfare against the working class. And they really see it that way, but they get called racist by the leftists for caring about immigration. Trump showed up and said, "I understand that for you, immigration is an economic consideration, and I'm going to put that front and center." And he did. And for that, he's become a real hero for the working class and increasingly the multi-ethnic working class. So he's now polling very high with Black men, and he's getting the majority of Hispanic votes. So all of this narrative about the white working class really turned out to be nothing more than wishful thinking on the left.
That's so interesting. Batya Ungasagan's my guest. She's the deputy editor of Newsweek, and her book is called Second Class: How the Elites Betrayed America's Working Men and Women. That's really interesting, isn't it? The rise in support for Donald Trump by people of colour. And that's going to take some explaining, I suspect, from the people who you talk about in the liberal elite. I mean, how do they explain that if it's not racism?
Yeah, I mean, they first of all, there's a lot of denial going on about this. There's a lot of sort of hand-wringing, but then also a lot of, they simply refuse to understand it. I mean, they're very much in denial about it. Black men are voting for Trump, or planning to vote for Trump, because the economy was so much better under him for working class people. And they understand that this new addiction to, you know, open borders and illegal immigration on the part of the Democrats is coming at their expense, which is something that Democrats used to know. As recently as the 90s, Bill Clinton put the civil rights icon Barbara Jordan in charge of an immigration commission, and she concluded that mass migration was going to have a deeply harmful effect, and already was having a deeply harmful effect on the Black community, because these illegal migrants were going to be driving down the wages of working class men, among whom Black men are disproportionately counted. And I got to tell you, Jesse, when I was reporting my book, when I was traveling around the country, I didn't meet a single Black man who was planning to vote for Biden. And I thought something must be off with my methodology. Something must be off. This must be selection bias. You know, I thought there's no way. I mean, we know he only got 18% of Black men in 2020. But now the polling is showing that he's, you know, he's polling at 35% of Black men. And, you know, when he got 18% of Black men, he had been polling at 8%. So I think that my my numbers were maybe not as far off as I thought.
We probably don't have the time to go into this here, but I do just want to note that there would be people in the US who would object to your characterization of the economy as being better for the working class under Trump. We won't argue it here. And also, I think some people would take issue that the Democrats weren't doing anything about immigration. I've seen plenty of coverage that Biden tried to get a particular law through to close up that border, but was foiled by Republicans who possibly saw it as a potential election motivator for voters. I want to talk about the college degree thing. Why does it matter? Why is that the dividing line?
You know, if you have a college degree in the United States today, you make on average $1 million more than a working class person. Your health outcomes are better. You live longer and you live a life protected from the deaths of despair that are really plaguing the downwardly mobile working class. On every measure, things are simply much, much better. You're much more likely to become a homeowner and much more likely to achieve the American dream. And the reason for that is simple. Over the course of the last 50 years, the Democrats went from representing labor to representing the college educated. And as a result, they created policy after policy after policy, starting with NAFTA, then defunding vocational training, you know, free trade with China, as we mentioned, offshoring of manufacturing, opening the border, you know, in 2019, every single Democrat who was running for office, except for one, raised their hand in answer to a question about whether they would decriminalize illegal border crossing, which Joe Biden then proceeded to do. So, you know, on all of these issues, they started catering to these college educated elites, creating an economy that was extremely rewarding to knowledge industry jobs and extremely punishing to working class jobs. And that was just not an accident. That there was nothing natural about that. You know, before that, you had the Democrats representing labor up through the 70s and the Republicans representing, you know, tax cuts and free trade and all of this. But the Democrats really joined them in this sort of reshaping of the economy around the knowledge industry. And, you know, what it ended up doing was it was a massive upward transfer of wealth from the working class to the elites. It was a plunder of the middle class, effectively, where the middle class got squeezed both up and down to where now the top 20% controls over 50% of the GDP. You know, those people, the college educated elites, they like to rail against the 1%. But the share of the economy that the 1% controls has not significantly changed over the last 50 years. It's the top 20% who have really, really bolstered their fortunes and now control more than half of the GDP.
Why doesn't Gord McGill, the logging truck driver who you rode along with, why doesn't he see this? Why doesn't he take student loan out and get a college degree and join the people prospering by the system you're describing?
You know something, Jesse, we're very lucky he doesn't do that, because then who would deliver our logs and who would deliver our food? I mean, we're really, really lucky that a lot of working class people don't want to go to college, because over 50% of people with a college degree are already underemployed, meaning they're working in jobs that don't require the skills that they learned, although infuriatingly, they're still making more than their working class counterparts. So our economy actually is already oversubscribed with college educated people. We simply have enough accountants and lawyers and gender study podcasters and radio, public radio hosts and journalists.
Oi, hang on a second. Yeah, no, carry on.
I mean, we have enough, right? How would you feel if there were suddenly 35 million more people applying for your job? You wouldn't feel great, right? You know, if suddenly like every Danish journalist decided to come and move to New Zealand, right? You might take issue with that. But instead, what we do is we protect those jobs and, you know, undercut, you know, the truckers. But so on the one hand, people don't actually want to go to college. And on the other hand, that's a really good thing. Like, we actually really, really rely as a society on people whose jobs are, to us, would be very mundane or would be, you know, very difficult. We rely on there being people who get a lot of dignity out of changing the diapers of the elderly, for example. We are very lucky that there are millions of Americans who would rather do that than go to college. And yet, instead of having a sense of gratitude towards God and towards them and saying, you know what, you too will be able to be a homeowner, because it is disgusting for me to rely on your labor, which I wouldn't want to do, and then say, oh, and by the way, you're always going to have to be worried about whether or not you could pay rent. You will never be able to retire. You will be terrified every time the electrical bill comes, right? That's unacceptable. I mean, that should be unacceptable to any civilized person.
We hear, to that point, we hear this story quite often that locals won't take the tough jobs. There's fruit on the trees that need picking. The locals won't do it, so we get people in, from Pacific Islands, in New Zealand's case, cleaning. That's another job that apparently, resident New Zealanders don't want to do. Is that contrary to what you hear from workers, what you heard from workers when you were traveling America?
Yeah, 100%. There is no job that is undignified. It is working conditions that are undignified, and the way that you fix that is by making them dignified, right? Make them pay a living wage, have reasonable hours, have workplace protection, secure, you know, a retirement. Like, there's nothing inherently better about any job. It's just whether or not it can protect the worker and their dignity. I met a lot of people who get a lot of dignity from cleaning toilets, and yet their jobs are becoming unlivable because they are competing with teams made up entirely of illegal migrants who are willing to work for $9 an hour. That's not right. I mean, you have people in our class, Jesse, who are moving upstate and buying land and becoming homesteaders. Like, it would never occur to anybody to say, oh, that's undignified. No, we are all jealous of them, right? Like, it's obvious that there's dignity in every job. It's just a question of whether a person is being treated in a dignified manner by the person that employs them.
Are terms like left wing and right wing still useful when you're analyzing not just politics, but the populace?
No, not at all. They're totally irrelevant. I mean, what would you call me, right? I've always insisted I'm on the left, but once you're talking like this about the working class and the left has totally abandoned these concerns, like what difference does it make anyway? I found that there was very little that distinguished working class conservatives and working class
Oh,
liberals,
gosh.
both in terms of values and in terms of ideology and in terms of politics.
Even on social issues, right? People aren't really arguing about gay marriage anymore.
The most common view I heard, and this was including from very, very religious Christians, was people were extremely pro-gay and extremely worried about the transgender ideology. They were extremely in favor of limiting immigration, both legal and illegal, and they wanted some version of government-backed health care. They really, really hated welfare and that people could choose to live off the government, but they also supported higher taxes on corporations and the rich. So is that left or right? It's somewhere in the middle. And in America, at least before Trump, you had each party had sort of one piece of the puzzle, but was actively undermining the other piece of it. And so, you know, it's sort of a crapshoot for them who they vote for.
You spoke to what sounds like quite an incredible woman who works all the hours she can. Nicole Day, she does gig jobs, she does babysitting, and she does that in part because she needs flexibility to help her elderly parents. What does she want from her political leaders, and I guess what do they need to know about her life and her challenges?
You know, Nicole was one of the most humble people I've ever met. When I met her, she had no teeth because there was only one dentist that took the health insurance that she had, and he was booked up for 6 months. So for 6 months, she didn't have teeth because she had lost her teeth to an infection. Never complained about it. Never complained about anything. When I met her, she was driving a car that had no windows. She drives for DoorDash. And she was driving around making these deliveries in a car whose windows were boarded up with cardboard because her car had broken down and she had to drive her dad's car, and her dad's car had no windows and she just didn't have any money to fix it. Never complains anything. Every opportunity that comes her way, she's grateful for. The thing that she brought up a lot was, she said that there's no opportunities for people who don't have a college degree. She's very talented. She's very bright. She's a great writer. She could do great content writing, but all of the jobs in that arena are funneled through software that, if you don't have a college degree, immediately drops you out from consideration. So she would never even get an interview in any of these jobs that she would have been so good at. I'm going to tell you, Jesse, like, it broke my heart. I said to her, how much money would you need a year to feel, you know, just to be secure, to feel like you didn't have to worry every night? Can you imagine her number? It was $35,000 a year. Like, that's what it would take for this woman to be com to have all of her needs completely fulfilled and be able to get her kid, you know, everything that he needs. I mean, the modesty of their desires, it really, really, really humbled me. Because, like, it's just the idea that that would be out of reach for a person who's working three jobs. I mean, what kind of a society is this? And the answer from the left again would be, oh, we'll give you affordable housing. Oh, we'll give you food stamps. She doesn't want any of that. I mean, she doesn't qualify for that because she makes like $5 a month too much. You know, I think she's making, you know, between 18 and $22,000 a year. But she doesn't want that. What she wants is for her labor to deliver her with the most modest version of a stable life.
How's your book been received, Betcha?
I'm really humbled by the reception. Each interviewer has connected with a different character in the book. The people who I wrote the book about have responded really well to it. They feel really proud to be in it, and all of this has been unbelievably humbling. And also, I got to tell you, everyone told me not to write this book, so the fact that it's, you know, selling really well and that people are connecting to the material and the ideas and the idea that, you know, this is a nonpartisan issue, I feel very humbled and grateful to God that it all shook out this way.
I think, was it this book or the book before you had trouble getting interest from a publisher, and it was because you'd sort of discovered that polarization, this thing we all rely on as a given, was not really reflected in the numbers, and you were quite keen to tell the world about it, and you couldn't really understand why publishers didn't want that story told. And I think someone
Yeah.
said to you, what did the publisher eventually say to you, that you should write a book about why I don't believe you?
Wow, you have such a great memory, Jesse. Yeah, that's exactly what happened. And you know, what's funny now is I did get to write a version of that book. Because the working class is so not polarized. And so I definitely, wove a lot of threads into that. And I feel like people are much more willing to hear that message now.
Yeah, that's. I'm almost done with you, Bachi, and I'll let you get back to your busy life. But I wonder if that's the barrier for a book like this, is that before people will listen to you or take the book seriously, they have to work out whose side you're on. This is a particularly a US thing, but I think it's probably a New Zealand thing as well. Well, hang on, is she a conservative commentator? I've heard does some stuff for Fox News. No, apparently she's a Marxist. Oh, so let's work out whose side you're on, and then we'll work out whether we'll listen to what you've got to say. Is that accurate?
It's totally accurate, and I'm very grateful to you because, there's not a lot of public radio stations that would have me on in America only because, the minute you say anything nice about Trump, whether it's about the Abraham Accords or whether it's about the fact that many working class Americans of all races think that he made the economy better for them, you become barred from certain outlets. And that's astonishing, right? Like somebody who's representing the way, how many votes did he get? 72 million, 78 million of our fellow Americans think should be barred from, 90% of the journalism in America because the journalists are opposed to that person. It's also so silly because it would be so easy for the Democrats to turn this ship around and get all those voters back who are defecting to Trump. And my book has like the formula. I mean, it's so obvious and so easy how they could get them back, but they don't want to hear it because they're very attached to the path they've chosen, and they'd rather, as we started, with, they'd rather blame the voters than deliver for them.
Real pleasure to talk to you. Thanks so much.
God bless you, Jesse. Thank you so much.
Batya Ungasagan, deputy editor of Newsweek, her book is called Second Class: How the Elites Betrayed America's Working Men and Women.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.